Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with the Christian Science Monitor for Tuesday, October 7th, 2025. And here are today's news briefs. EU proposed protections for steel industry. It proposed cutting by almost half its tariff-free quota on steel and steel products. That would effectively add large tariffs on imports from countries including China, India, Turkey, and the United Kingdom, which said the measures would wreck the British steel industry. After reaching a new quota of 18.3 million tons, additional imports will face a 50% tariff. This is double the current 25% rate, a high price akin to U.S. President Donald Trump's steel measures. Neighboring nations such as Norway, Iceland, and Ukraine will be exempt. Associated Press. Nobel Prize in Physics awarded for work in quantum mechanics. Scientists John Clark, Michael H. Devoret, and John M. Martinez won for their research into the weird world of subatomic quantum tunneling that advances the power of everyday digital communications and computing. The research conducted in the mid-1980s explores how subatomic interactions have real-world applications. Experts say it could enhance computing, communications, and even cryptography. The Nobel Prize announcements continue throughout the week, with the award ceremony set for December 10th. Associated Press. Solar grew at record pace worldwide in the first half of 2025. Renewables have overtaken coal for the first time, according to a new report by clean energy think tank Ember. Solar, along with some wind power, more than met the rise in global electricity demand. While the United States has expanded fossil fuel production, China did the opposite and led the world in new solar energy generation. Staff. France began search for new prime minister again. Sébastien Lecornu became the shortest-serving prime minister in French history when he resigned Monday after 27 days in office. France is now looking for a fifth prime minister in less than a year, after conservatives objected to Mr. Lecornu's choice of defense minister. On Tuesday, Edouard Philippe, President Emmanuel Macron's first prime minister and ally, called for Mr. Macron's resignation and early presidential elections. Staff. Government shutdown affecting U.S. flights. Air traffic control staffing shortages impacted multiple airports due to the partial government shutdown, the Federal Aviation Administration said Monday. The White House backed off President Donald Trump's assertion that government employees were being laid off, but warned of potential firings as the shutdown stretches into its seventh day. Lawmakers resolved the last shutdown in 2019 after absences of airport controllers and security screeners spiked. Reuters. Canada's Prime Minister to meet with Trump. Tuesday's meeting in Washington will require a delicate political balancing act with tariffs on aluminum, steel, and lumber. The Canadian economy is starting to show signs of strain, but many Canadians want to keep their elbows up, the hockey slogan that helped bring Prime Minister Mark Carney to victory against Mr. Trump's tariffs and annexation threats. Mr. Carney's approval remains high, but has dipped as Canadians lost patience with the uncertainty. Staff. Violent crime in Detroit dropped again. It fell below last year's 60-year low, the city said Monday. Homicides dropped by 15% and non-fatal shootings by 22%. Last week, the Michigan legislature approved a budget that doles out $95 million for public safety, with the largest share earmarked for municipalities with high crime rates. The news comes as President Donald Trump mobilizes the National Guard to cities he deems unsafe. Staff. India and China to resume direct flights after 5-year freeze. It's the latest in a series of moves to normalize ties between the neighboring superpowers as steep U.S. tariffs force Delhi to rethink its alliances. China-India relations, which collapsed after a deadly 2020 border clash, have long been marked by distrust and competition. But during Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's visit to China last month, he and Chinese leader Xi Jinping described their countries as partners, not rivals. Staff. Our first article today is on the Middle East. Distrustful of U.S. and Israel, Palestinians are cool to Trump's Gaza plan. By Gada Abdulfatah, special contributor, and Taylor Luck, special correspondent. Deir al-Balah, Gaza Strip, and Ramallah, West Bank. While the international community, Trump's administration, and swaths of Israeli society have welcomed the proposal, peace deal announced by the U.S. President Donald Trump last week and agreed to in part by Hamas, Palestinians in Gaza, and the West Bank remain deeply skeptical. Negotiations on the details progressed on Tuesday in Cairo between Hamas, Israel, and the United States, but a lack of trust in both Israel and the U.S. intensified by a 2-year war that some experts say has become genocide, has helped Palestinians believing that even should Israel and Hamas strike a deal, the plan will not lead to peace. Many Palestinians see President Trump's latest foray into Middle East diplomacy as a superficial bid for the Nobel Prize rather than an actual attempt at securing long-term peace. Even among Palestinians who hope the agreement will be a step towards ending the war, many say it comes as too little and far too late. In the past, when people heard about ceasefire talks, they would cheer, ululate, applaud. This time, no one even smiled, says Tamer Misala, as he attempts to repair his sandal in his makeshift tent in Deir al-Balah. People are afraid to feel hope. The Trump plan calls on Hamas to release all living and dead Israeli hostages, give up power in Gaza, and surrender its arms. In return, Israel would end the war and release Palestinian prisoners, and an international board would govern the enclave on an interim basis. Many say that has put both Hamas and the Palestinian people in a tough position. I'm not biased towards any political party, but when I look at Donald Trump's plan, I can't see any benefit for us as Palestinians, says Safan Abu Mahdi, an Arabic tutor, as her children play in a dusty plot outside her tent in Sharab Camp, the largest displacement camp in Deir al-Balah. If we reject it, it will be bad for us. If we accept it, it will also be bad for us. Most of the points in this plan are not for us, she says. Israel doesn't act transparently. The U.S. doesn't act transparently. No one does. Even if a deal is signed, I don't believe Israel will keep its word, says Mr. Misala, noting that the Trump plan gives Israel full control of Gaza's perimeter. Maybe they won't invade Gaza again, but they still control everything. The food, the cash, the crossings. Even when they're not there, they will control us. Abu Ahmed Ismail Abu Isaid, a displaced farmer who says Israel killed 35 members of his family, shares Gazans' disbelief that the war will indeed stop after so many dashed hopes and collapsed deals. Since the beginning of this war, we've been telling ourselves things will be clearer tomorrow, but nothing comes clearer. I can't believe there will be a ceasefire until I see it with my own eyes, says Mr. Abu Isad, after from his tent on the rented plot of farmland he now tends. There is no trust left. It is a distant distrust that extends directly to the U.S. and to the Trump administration. Most of the weapons used against us are American-made, says Mr. Abu Issaid. America strikes us from one side and sympathizes with us on the other. But in the agreement, we are left out, marginalized, forgotten by all parties. We are the ones paying the price of this war. The suddenness with which Mr. Trump pushed for a Gaza deal also gives many pause. America has known about the war for 2 years, and then suddenly, in 2 days, they wanted for it to stop, says Mr. Abu Mahdi, the Arabic teacher, whose 3 siblings have been killed by Israel strikes. I know something is wrong, but still I just want the war to stop. Palestinians in Gaza are quick to point out that the mass destruction of infrastructure, the long-term health impacts of famine, and a generational loss of income, homes, land, and education cannot be undone easily. We are thrown into the streets without food or water. Our children's lives and futures are shattered, says Mr. Abu Issaid, whose 10-acre plot of fruit and olive trees he once relied on has been damaged by the Israel military. There are no homes, no streets, no water. Even if we return to our lands, we return to nothing. Palestinian residents of the West Bank, where Israel military closures, checkpoints, and settler violence continue to choke movement in daily life, also voiced skepticism that the agreement and Hamas's concessions would lead to peace, or even impact their lives. We hope that Trump will move positively, and we hope that the Palestinian people will move positively with the agreement, which Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is clearly against, says Mr. Ali Al-Jariri, an academic and supervisor of the Hebrew Language Department at the Ramallah-based Al-Quds Open University. Israelis and Palestinians have to learn that war will not bring results on either side, he says. Peace will bring development to the entire Middle East, and it will if Trump is serious about pursuing the Nobel Prize. But he cautions we are living in a time when the might of thugs and bullies rules over the will of everyday people. West Bank Palestinians say they do not believe Mr. Trump's pursuit of a deal is an altruistic push for peace. They are just chasing after a Nobel Prize, says Duad Zar, a retiree in Ramallah who, like many, struggles to reach his lands and home outside Ramallah because of settler violence in Israeli military checkpoints and closures. The plan, he believes, shows the U.S. and Israel don't want a Palestinian state. Israel will take the hostages and then destroy Gaza. They push the Palestinian Authority to the side. They only care about the optics for the Nobel Prize. They don't care about us Palestinians or our basic rights, he says. Even the Arab states are against us, he says, of Arab support for the Trump deal. This plan is just an ad campaign for Trump to do business deals in the Middle East and sell American weapons. It has nothing to do with peace, says Bihaya Itaya, a mother of 3 in Ramallah, who notes that Israel checkpoints have extended the 5-mile drive from Ramallah to her house in a nearby village to a 1-hour commute. Things are getting worse on the ground, and the killing hasn't stopped. The Nobel Prize Committee should stay far, far away from Trump. Concerns are mounting, particularly over the lack of details in the plan, such as whether and when Gaza will be handed over to the Palestinian Authority, or PA, which governs the West Bank, for a time frame for Israel to withdraw from Gaza. There are fears over this plan because there are no guarantees that the war won't resume or that Israel won't intensify its efforts in the West Bank, explains Karima, a human resource manager in Ramallah who declined to give her full name. This plan gives no guarantees or steps to show the Israeli attempt to deny us our basic rights or erase us from these lands, she says. Dr. Sabri Saidam, a senior official at Fatah, the dominant party in the PA, noted that the authority initially welcomed the plan to stop bloodshed. Yet the plan's lack of clarity has left it a mere outline open to interpretation. Deepening concerns is the foreign-run board, headed by President Trump and former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, to oversee Gaza's administration. The plan is bringing people outside to run Palestinian life. This is feared by many Palestinians as a resurrection of the colonial past, Dr. Saidem says. Palestine is for the Palestinians, and Palestine is to be run by those Palestinians. Eye on the Peace Prize. Why Trump Might Show More Patience with Gaza Diplomacy. By Howard LaFranchi, staff writer, Washington. By now, the world has grown accustomed to a U.S. president who runs hot and cold on the international conflicts facing him, his interest in addressing them waxing and waning as prospects for quick resolution ebb. Russia's war in Ukraine, once a daily focus of President Donald Trump this year, that now seems to have largely fallen off his radar screen, is one example. But the Israeli-Hamas war in Gaza appears to be maintaining a tight hold on the mercurial president's attention. As negotiators for Israel and Hamas sit down in Egypt for indirect talks that many say represent the best opportunity yet for bringing the two-year war to a close, Mr. Trump is demonstrating a focus on the conflict and offering daily clues as to why this one, for him, is different. For one thing, a president who considers himself the world's greatest dealmaker is obsessed with the challenge of delivering not just a ceasefire and the release of the hostages that Hamas holds in Gaza, some diplomats and foreign policy experts say. Grander still is Mr. Trump's ambition, based on the 20-point plan carrying his name, to deliver peace to a conflict that American presidents have tried and failed to resolve for three quarters of a century. It looks like you could have peace in the Middle East for the first time in 3,000 years, Mr. Trump declared to reporters on the White House lawn Saturday. We're going to have more than Gaza. We're going to have Gaza plus peace, he added. I'm very honored to be part of that. Moreover, the war in Gaza offers the perfect combination of opportunities prone to sustaining the attention of businessman Donald Trump, some analysts say. President Trump sees this as the moment to achieve a ceasefire, ensure the return of the hostages, and bring about what he calls a lasting peace where others have failed, says Rajan Menon, a senior research fellow at Columbia University, Saltzman Institute of War and Peace Studies. But beyond that, he sees this crucial moment increasing his chances for winning the Nobel Peace Prize and clearing the way for the massive economic development plan he has in mind for Gaza, he adds. That plan would launch at a time when he and his family have substantially expanded their business dealings in the Middle East. President Trump has been nominated for this year's Nobel Peace Prize, which is set to be announced Friday. On Tuesday, he released a letter he wrote to a group of Israeli hostages' families, thanking them for their endorsement for the nomination. Yet even with all the extraordinary factors underpinning Mr. Trump's interest in Gaza, negotiating of the key sticking points standing in the way of the final deal are sure to test the president's patience, analysts say. On Monday, Mr. Trump was admonishing negotiators for the parties to act fast, even before his own team, headed by Special Advisor Steve Witkoff and son-in-law Jared Kushner, had traveled to Cairo for the talks. He conferred with the pair on Tuesday morning at the White House. We're certainly closer to a deal on Gaza than ever before, and that's what's allowed the president to take a victory lap as the parties gather in Egypt to hammer things out, says David Schenker, a former Assistant Secretary of State for the Near Eastern Affairs during the first Trump administration. But the 20-point plan is quite ambitious. It really encompasses a long list of very complex issues that we shouldn't expect can be worked out in a matter of days, as adds Mr. Schenker, now a senior fellow in Arab politics at the Washington Institute for Near East policy. I agree it's the moment to seize the momentum, but there's also the real danger of going down rabbit holes. President Trump is likely to find more patience for concluding a Gaza peace plan because so much rides on ending the war, Mr. Schenker adds. From further progress on the Abraham Accords, normalizing relations between Israel and its Arab neighbors, to the long-sought redeployment of U.S. forces from the region. It's all tied to the Gaza peace plan, Mr. Schenker says, and everyone understands that. The White House appeared to acknowledge on Monday that the full peace plan is not likely to be hammered out in a matter of a few days, as Mr. Trump suggested over the weekend. Instead, the thinking seems to be that quick agreement on the release of hostages and a ceasefire would provide the momentum to solving their other issues. It's very important that we get this done quickly so that we can get some momentum, get the hostages out, and then move to the next part of this, which is really ensuring that we can create a lasting, durable peace in Gaza and ensure that Gaza is a place that no longer threatens the security of Israel or the United States, White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said at a briefing. A big question is whether Hamas would agree to a hostage release without other guarantees. For example, that Israel would not simply resume the war once the hostages are out. Part of a Hamas yes, but to Trump's plan is their very real concern that without some specific and binding guarantees in place, Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu would take the win of the hostages' release and continue the war, said Dr. Menon. Agreeing on a plan for the hostages' release will be hard enough. The Trump plan calls for all hostages to be released within 72 hours of a deal. But locating and securing all of them, including the bodies of deceased hostages, would stretch into weeks, some experts warn. But as complex as the hostages' release could be, it might pale in comparison with the complexity of other outstanding issues. Those include Hamas's disarmament, Israel's withdrawal, and the future governance of Gaza. Any one of these could take many days or even weeks to resolve, some experts say. Such timelines would appear to be at odds with Mr. Trump's calls for acting fast and concluding a deal in a matter of days. Dr. Menon says he doesn't anticipate the president losing interest, given everything that's at stake. But Dr. Menon adds that if talks bog down in the complexities, Mr. Trump could lose patience. The question now is who he loses patience with first, Hamas or Israel, Dr. Menon says. Mr. Netanyahu almost certainly has the edge for avoiding Mr. Trump's full wrath, experts say. But Mr. Schenker recalls how Israel's missile attack on Hamas negotiators in Qatar in September was a watershed moment for Mr. Trump, along with the more recent White House leak to the media of the president's exasperation with Mr. Netanyahu that he's always so bleeping negative. Both should serve as warnings to the Israeli leader that he can't push too far, he says. Still, the key to Mr. Trump's patience with a complex peace process is going to be his sense that things are moving forward towards the final prize. Whether it takes 48 hours or starts to stretch out into days, Mr. Schenker says, if there's a sense that there's progress, then I think even for President Trump, the amount of time it's taking matters less. October 7th, plus 2 years. In Israel, fatigue, lingering anger, a glimmer of hope. By Dinah Kraft, Special Correspondent, Tel Aviv, Israel. On about day 15 of Israel's war with Hamas, and before the Israeli army's clearly imminent ground invasion of Gaza had begun, I steeled myself for a four-month war. I was still hovering between shock, horror, and fear like everyone else around me in Israel for following Hamas's October 7th massacre and mass hostage taking. Back then, it was still being called Ha-Shabbat, Ha-Shakorah, the Black Sabbath. 4 months, I thought, was surely an overestimation. Yet, like a long-distance runner preparing for a race with no clear finish line ahead, I thought better to prepare mentally for a long haul. But Tuesday marks 2 years of war since that day of bulldozed border fences and killing spree along Israel's southern border that claimed the lives of 12,000 civilians and soldiers alike inside army posts and family bedrooms and at an outdoor music festival. Memorials are being held this week at the kibbutzim overrun by Hamas, where some neighborhoods were reduced to rows of blackened, burned-out homes with their melted lawn furniture and scattered tricycles and soccer balls waiting for children who will never return. These frozen scenes speak to the sense in Israel that even 2 years to the day later, and with the final details of a possible peace being renegotiated as Israelis and Palestinians look on with bated breath, the country feels stuck in a state of suspended animation. When the hostages are back, Israel can focus on healing itself as a society. The protest leaders, hostage families, and regular people tell one another. For now, a fundamental societal covenant of not leaving anyone behind in the field of battle lies shattered by the hostages' long ordeal awaiting repair. Meanwhile, over 2 years, the visual landscape around us has transformed, still bathing passers-by with reminders of the bloodiest day in Israel history. Murals depict those kills, like the one emblazoning the outdoor wall of my neighborhood pizza parlor of a young couple killed at the music festival. Stickers plaster walls at bus stops and train stations, and are on benches and even the trailhead of a hiking path in the Galilee I walked last week. Each bears the face of a young person killed that day or in its aftermath, and usually a quote and a barcode with more details by which to remember them. That sense of emotional exhaustion, a communal inability to breathe, has been compounded by an ever-rising toll of soldiers' deaths in Gaza, reinforcing that are the unresolved questions and anger over the motives of a government strategy to prosecute a prolonged war seeking total victory over Hamas, which many criticize as a way to evade political responsibility for leaving the southern border catastrophically unprotected on October 7th. Recently, a soldier's mother went from obscurity to an appearance on the nightly news for her viral social media post, describing why she drove to her son's base the day before he was to re-enter Gaza, intending to physically block him from going. She did not succeed even in entering the base, but on TV she explained that after 2 years of trying to keep things together, she had broken and was willing to be seen as falling apart before her son, if that would save his life in a war she no longer believed in. Other parents wrote her, saying her public confession spoke for them. Some sectors of society were debating the morality of military service if this is indeed a political war, not a defensive war of no choice, that Israelis initially prided themselves in fighting just after October 7th attack. The morality of the devastating civilian toll in Gaza, where tens of thousands have been killed, is less discussed as people remain largely focused on their individual and collective trauma. That said, an inner moral accounting has grown in recent months. Some left-wing intellectuals have been saying the quiet part out loud. How will Israel, a state founded as a refuge for persecuted people, recover from the stain of what Gaza's civilians have endured? I feel ill every time I receive English translations of the Israeli army's text messages to Gazans, warning them to leave certain neighborhoods ahead of planned airstrikes, and then hear the roar of jets that usually follows. Not long after come WhatsApp messages from Palestinian sources with the number of people wounded and killed and images of soot-covered children looking for parents. Meanwhile, many Israelis feel highly defensive in the face of mass anti-war protests abroad and the outright questioning within some of them of Israel's very right to exist, Soaring anti-Semitic attacks in Europe and America impact the Israeli mindset. Friends and neighbors ask me about how bad anti-Semitism is in America when I return from visits, assuming it lurks behind every corner. A new Hebrew University poll suggests 2025 was even harder for Israelis to bear than 2024. The portion of those who are pessimistic about the state of the country is growing, rising from 34% in 2024 to 48% now. Fewer than one quarter are confident that their children will live better lives than they have. The survey also found about 24% of Israelis have considered leaving the country, including 33% of opposition voters. In a country where army reservists have lost hundreds of days of work serving in either Gaza or along the northern border with Lebanon, 45% report financial harm from the war. That number is markedly higher for Israeli Arab citizens, 84%. Those conducting the survey summarized what they say as a darker emotional climate summed up in one word, fatigue. Another important finding, 61% of Israelis rank social and political polarization and violence as more of a threat than external enemies. I thought of the depth of our national and personal sense of exhaustion last week when a siren sounded at 1 a.m. My family and I, along with our neighbors, as we have done too often to count in the last 2 years, stumbled down the stairs to our apartment building's bomb shelter, a room in which normal times is simply a big dusty storage space of reinforced concrete containing bicycles and strollers. For months, it's been missiles and drones from Houthis, Iran's proxies in Yemen, that have roused us from sleep. The Iran war in June had an entirely different level of danger and fear. After the requisite 10-minute all clear, I watched one of my youngest neighbors, a 4-year-old, Yuri, get up from his spot on one of the beanbags put out for just such occasions and walk towards the door. I offered to carry him back to bed, but he shook his small curly head no. Eyes half-masked, he marched straight upstairs. Going through the motions exhausted is not new to him. It's been the experience of half his life. Monday evening ushers in the Sukkot holiday, when Jews recall their exodus from Egypt and build desert huts called Sukkahs, flimsy yet tangible representations of safety and shelter. The hope for Israelis this year is that everyone finds their way home to that. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org, and click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take Sun Sounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. In first big case of the term, Supreme Court tackles free speech and LGBTQ rights. By Stephen Humphrey, staff writer, Sophie Hill, staff writer, and Cameron Pugh, staff writer. Since 2020, the U.S. Supreme Court has adjudicated two landmark cases involving transgender-related rights. Its new term includes several more. These closely watched cases could have seismic ramifications, especially if the court addresses whether transgender individuals deserve civil rights protections as a class. First on the docket, the 9 justices heard oral arguments on Tuesday about whether Colorado can ban a therapist from practicing conversion therapy on LGBTQ plus minors. Childs versus Salazar, brought by a plaintiff who is a therapist and a Christian, revolves around free speech. Later this term, the court will also mull a pair of cases involving states banning transgender athletes from participating in girls' sports. Little versus Hecox and West Virginia versus BPJ involve questions about the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause and the boundary lines of Title I-X. The cases center around a very different constitutional question, but they're coming before the Supreme Court at a time when the country is embroiled in a culture war over the rights of transgender people. It is yet another in a series of constitutional tests over how a document ratified in 1788 addressed modern issues the Founding Fathers couldn't have anticipated. In Childs v. Salazar, one side argues that the case is all about free speech. The other says it's about the right of states to regulate medical care. Which question the justices find more persuasive might determine the outcome. Colorado, like more than half the states and the District of Columbia, has banned or placed limits on licensed counselors from engaging in conversion therapy. With those under 18, the practice is defined as attempting to change someone's gender identity or sexual orientation. Kaylee Childs, a licensed counselor and practicing Christian, sued the Centennial State in 2022. The plaintiff engages in talk therapy with individuals who are uncomfortable with their sexual orientation or are experiencing gender dysphoria. Her clients are often fellow Christians who seek her instead of enlisting a secular therapist. Ms. Childs has repeatedly declined in interviews with news outlets to say whether she wishes to offer her clients conversion therapy. "I want to be able to speak genuinely, openly, have full conversations with my clients," Ms. Childs told ABC News. "Without the state kind of peering into my office in these completely private conversations." The primary legal question at play in Childs v. Salazar is a doctrinal question of free speech law, says Rick Garnett, who heads the program on church, state, and society at University of Notre Dame's Law School in Indiana. Namely, what's the distinction between regulations of conduct and regulations of expression? The court, he says, has a deep well of case law to draw upon in making its ruling. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Tenth Circuit upheld the Colorado law, ruling that the ban did not violate freedom of religion or speech. The Supreme Court did not take up the freedom of religion question. It's only examining the free speech question. A majority of justices appeared sympathetic to Ms. Childs' argument on Tuesday. "Just because they are engaged in conduct doesn't mean their words aren't protected," Chief Justice John Roberts said. Several leading medical groups, including the American Medical Association and the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, have condemned conversion therapy as ineffective and inhumane. Multiple studies have found a heightened risk of depression and suicide among those who undergo it. During oral arguments, James Campbell, a lawyer for Ms. Childs, disputed the evidence that conversion therapy is harmful, saying that the studies don't prove causation and were flawed because of biased sampling. Some religious groups argue that the ban constitutes viewpoint discrimination against counselors who seek to change their clients' gender identities or sexual orientations, and patients who wish to undergo that process. On Tuesday, that appeared to be a persuasive argument for a court whose justices hold free speech as sacrosanct. For a lot of religious liberty activists and a lot of religious counselors, they see this law as imposing a particular burden on their ability to engage in counseling that is consistent with their religious beliefs, Professor Garnett says. "This court is very protective of free speech," he adds. "Most of the justices are on the record as being very skeptical about what we call viewpoint-based regulations of speech. In this case, the viewpoint being discriminated against would be the Christian therapist who believed that children diagnosed with gender dysphoria need therapy to resolve their feelings of conflict, not gender transition treatment." Going to Tuesday's hearing, Justices Neil Gorsuch and Amy Coney Barrett were seen as pivotal votes. Neither appeared convinced by Colorado's arguments, with Justice Gorsuch at one point saying, "I'm asking you about the logic of your argument." On the other hand, LGBTQ plus activists say Colorado and other states are within their rights to ban or otherwise regulate conversion therapy, given the medical consensus that the practice is both harmful and ineffective. The law does not apply to faith-based ministries or life coaches, Colorado Solicitor General Shannon Stevenson said. But after Ms. Stevenson said that a therapist would violate the state statute by engaging in a therapy for the purpose of changing a minor's sexual orientation or gender identity, a member of the liberal wing of the court appeared skeptical of arguments that Ms. Childs could not show enough harm to bring the case before the high court. "That settles the standing question," said Justice Sonia Sotomayor. Legal scholars on the left have argued that this is not truly a free speech case because Colorado law does not prohibit Christians and others, including Ms. Childs, to debate the merits of conversion therapy, just not while on the clock treating minors. "Most medical treatments involve some form of speech," says Josh Rovinger, legal director at GLAD Law, which advocates equal rights for LGBTQ Americans. "Extending the First Amendment into medical treatments that violate the standards of care is fundamentally changing the well-trodden authority states have to regulate medical practices," says Mr. Rovinger, who advised the Biden administration on issues of equity. The court's June ruling in United States versus Scarmetti, in which the court held that states have the right to ban gender transition treatment for transgender minors, could end up tipping the court towards Colorado in this case, Mr. Rovinger says, since the June ruling emphasized a principle that states have the authority to regulate medical care. "The overwhelming consensus is that these treatments don't work, and that's why they're being prohibited," says Lori Marhofer, who studies LGBTQ history at the University of Washington. "If the court says that the therapist's practice qualifies as speech protected under the First Amendment, then Colorado has to show a compelling government issue is interest in that is narrowly tailored. The compelling government interest would be avoiding harming minors with this type of therapy," says Timothy Holbrook, a law professor at Denver University's Sturm College of Law. In November, the justices will be refereeing a pair of cases related to sports. The legislatures of Idaho and West Virginia passed acts stipulating that men's and women's sports should be classified according to biological sex determined at birth. Those respective laws have been challenged by transgender athletes in West Virginia versus BPJ and Little versus Hecox. The plaintiff in the latter has asked the Supreme Court to dismiss the legal challenge because she has decided to withdraw from athletic competition. Idaho has requested that the case continue. The two sides offer competing interpretations of Title IX, which prohibits schools that receive federal funding from discriminating on the basis of sex. The tussle is over fairness. Advocates on the side of Little and West Virginia argue that those born biologically male have a strength advantage, particularly after puberty, and as a result, transgender women should be precluded from competing with biological women. They say it's a matter of protecting women's sports as part of Title IX. The challengers, on the contrary, say that it's unfair discrimination to ban someone who identifies as a girl from competing in the female category of sports. They argue that the bans constitute the very kind of discrimination Title IX seeks to prevent, and that it violates the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The cases both relate to female competitions, which have been more contentious than the issue of transgender boys participating in male sports. Though the case is about transgender athlete bans, it is possible, if not likely, that the Supreme Court will issue broader pronouncements about the scope of Title IX and the Equal Protection Clause, says Carrie Evans Wilson, a partner at Montgomery, McCracken, Walker, and Rhodes, a law firm whose specialties include Title IX cases. Whatever the holding of the court is, it will be applicable to many other areas that affect the rights of LGBTQIA+ students. Among those possible impacts, she says, the decision could shape policies over gender identity bathroom and locker room access for transgender individuals. It could impact future Title IX regulations regarding discrimination against LGBTQ athletes. and might even challenge policies in education institutions, such as preferred pronouns and name use. One legal question is whether, in keeping with the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause, individuals who identify as transgender are protected from discrimination on the basis of sex. Similar questions about equal protection came up in 2020, when the court extended federal anti-discrimination protections to LGBTQ workers in Bostock versus Clayton County. The 6-3 majority ruled that employers cannot fire an individual on the basis of the sexual orientation or gender identity. The decision, written by Justice Gorsuch, stated that it is impossible to discriminate against a person for being homosexual or transgender without discriminating against that individual based on sex. That decision came as a surprise to many court watchers, as both Justice Gorsuch and Chief Justice Roberts voted with the court's liberal wing. It was a landmark decision. Though the majority opinion referred to employment practices, other courts believed it had a wider application. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the 14th Circuit cited Bostock in the Title IX case that same year. In Grimm v. Gloucester County School Board, the appeals court said schools cannot bar transgender individuals from using restrooms that correspond to their gender identity. Court watchers wonder whether the justices will have to address Bostock and its new rulings. During its previous term, the court punted on an opportunity to do so when the court upheld a state ban that blocked gender transition treatment in Scrimeti. Justice Gorsuch wrote, "The court declines to address whether Bostock's reasoning reaches beyond that." One issue in Scrimeti was whether transgender individuals as a group ought to be entitled to a higher level of constitution protection. In other words, are transgender individuals a protected class? Justice Barrett expressed skepticism on that point. Historically, the court evaluated several considerations as to whether a group ought to be entitled to heightened protection, says Scott Skinner Thompson, a professor who focuses on LGBTQ issues at the University of Colorado Boulder's Law School. The key factors are whether it's an immutable characteristic, whether there is a history of discrimination, and whether they're politically powerless, says Mr. Skinner Thompson. GOP hits Democrats over health care. Unauthorized immigrants. What's behind the claim? By Caitlin Babcock, staff writer. Amid a government shutdown, the White House and its allies in Congress are repeating one talking point, perhaps more than any other. The Democrats continue to recklessly hold the American people hostage over their demands to give illegal aliens free health care, said White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt, as she opened a press briefing on Friday. Democrats are demanding a rollback of Medicaid cuts passed this summer in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, prepared with an extension of pandemic-era Affordable Care Act subsidies that are set to expire as a condition for ending the government shutdown. Republicans say that means unauthorized immigrants would have access to federally funded health care. Democrats say their changes are intended to benefit citizens and legal residents. Here's a look at how immigration status affects health care benefits, what the Democrats' proposal would really do, and what it means for the shutdown. In a memorandum released by the White House, the administration said Democrats were demanding reforms that would result in $200 billion in government spending for an unauthorized immigration, immigrants, and non-citizens. A KFF analysis of estimates from the Congressional Budget Office found that the Democrats' changes related to immigrants with legal status would increase federal spending by $131 billion. It did not provide an estimate for measures related to unauthorized immigrants. The claim hinges on the Republican bill that became law in July. When it was being drafted, the administration trumpeted that it would kick illegal immigrants off Medicaid. Immigrants who are in the country illegally are not eligible to enroll in Medicaid or Medicare. They also cannot purchase health care coverage through the Affordable Care Act. There are a few instances in which the government does pay for unauthorized immigrants to receive medical treatment. Hospitals are legally required to provide people with emergency treatment, regardless of their ability to pay or their immigration status. Hospitals can be reimbursed for these expenses through a program called Emergency Medicaid. The money, which includes federal dollars, covers emergency treatment for unauthorized immigrants who would have been eligible for Medicaid if not for their immigration status. There's a specific formula that is used, and the amount that the federal government pays varies across states, but both federal and state governments chip in to cover the cost of that emergency care, says Laura Wary, an associate professor of economics in New York University. Who qualifies for this depends on each state's standards for Medicaid eligibility and for what qualifies as an emergency. Emergency Medicaid uses federal money to help match states' payments to hospitals. That emergency money makes up less than 1% of Medicaid spending, which goes to people, including immigrants with legal status, as well as unauthorized immigrants. During her press briefing on Friday, Ms. Leavitt said it is not the administration's position that hospitals should refuse care to unauthorized immigrants, but she criticized former President Joe Biden for paroling immigrants into the country. Immigrants who have been granted parole are in the U.S. lawfully. A few states, including California and Illinois, have chosen to allow unauthorized immigrants to enroll in Medicaid programs. This is paid for with state dollars, not federal money. Republicans have criticized the possibility that higher reimbursement rates under Medicaid expansion, which Democrats want to restore, could mean some emergency care would be reimbursed at a higher rate for an unauthorized immigrant than for a U.S. citizen. Non-citizen immigrants who are in the country legally have varying levels of access to health care depending on their status. Many other immigrants with legal status are set to lose their Medicaid access because of the tax and spending bill. Under the bill, many immigrants, including refugees and people who have won asylum cases, will lose eligibility on October 1, 2026. These are people who have been granted permission to stay in the United States for protection from persecution. It's possible for a person to obtain asylum even if they cross the border illegally. Other groups of immigrants are also previously eligible to enroll in Medicaid. These include parolees, people temporarily allowed into the United States by discretion of the president, historically, often for urgent humanitarian reasons, and people protected from being sent back to their home countries where they may face danger. In addition, under the Biden administration, recipients of deferred action for childhood arrival, immigrants who were brought to the country as children, could enroll in Medicaid, though this was changed after Trump administration rule stopped defining them as legally present. The Republican bill stripped Medicaid eligibility for these groups, although it allows a few other types of non-citizens to keep their eligibility. The bill also limited, but did not end, federal payments to hospitals through the Emergency Medicaid program. Before the government shutdown, Republican lawmakers introduced a continuing resolution that would maintain current federal funding levels until November 21st. Democrats have demanded that the resolution include extension of Affordable Care Act subsidies that are set to expire at year's end, and a reversal of Medicaid cuts in the tax and spending bill. The Democrats' budget proposal would restore Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program, and Affordable Care Act coverage eligibility for immigrants with legal status who were eligible for it before the Republicans' bill, such as refugees or those paroled into the country. It would not make any unauthorized immigrants eligible for these programs. Republicans argue President Biden used a loose parole policy to allow far too many immigrants into the U.S. Restoring Medicaid access to these groups is only a part of Democrats' proposed changes. They also want to roll back provisions in the Republican spending bill that reduced federal funding for rural hospitals and imposed work requirements for citizens to be eligible for Medicaid. Describing this as about undocumented immigrants is quite misleading, says Benjamin Summers, a health economist at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. The shutdown is now on its seventh day, and a stalemate continues with no scheduled meetings between Republican and Democratic congressional leaders. And here's an opinion piece by The Monitor's View. Jane Goodall gave us a new view on all life. Camping out with chimps in their habitat allowed the conservationists to show humans their responsibilities for nature and to see a spiritual power beyond scientific knowledge, by The Monitor's editorial board. Like a great ape, we're going to go out on a limb and say that Jane Goodall ranks high in the list of people who have altered for the better the human relationship with nature. She did so less by words of warning than by insights on the shared and often unique qualities of chimpanzees in their African habitat. Her legacy as both a primatologist and a conservationist lies in her abiding focus on a better appreciation of the natural world, instead of an appreciation over its predicted demise. Around the planet, not just in a Tanzanian rainforest, Dr. Goodall saw delight more than dread, bonds over breaches. Without being pantheistic or sentimental, this British scientist who died this week spoke of a spiritual power that chimps and humans each express in, say, community compassion, while not neglecting their violent acts. Her patient observations of chimp behavior in the wild helped lift an understanding of life as more than material. She changed the way many people witness other living things each day, be it squirrel or bee. Her work stands alongside that of Rachel Carson or John Muir in expanding concepts about intelligence beyond what humans think of that word. She prepared us for difficult discussions about the impact and possibilities of artificial intelligence. During the pandemic, with all its fears of a virus, her insights on learning to understand nature before trying to exploit or obliterate it expanded the path to some sort of harmonious equilibrium with all of Earth's expressions, from climate to chimps. I hope we're going to learn a new relationship with the natural world, which we are a part of and which we depend on for our very existence, Dr. Goodall told the John Templeton Foundation in 2021. I'm internally thankful that my curiosity and desire to learn is as strong as when I was a child, and that I understand that the deep mysteries of life are forever beyond scientific knowledge, that now we see through a glass darkly, then face to face. That's all the time we have for today. Stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona and listen to more interesting programs. Thank you.